is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Gannon Baker, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
It's so important that from the ninth grade level through the varsity level that you all are speaking the same language.
Larry McKenzie is the boys' varsity head coach at Minneapolis North Community High School. He is the first coach to win four straight state titles in the 100-year history of the Minnesota High School Boys Basketball Tournament. In 2017, Coach McKenzie became the first coach in Minnesota high school basketball history to lead two separate schools to multiple titles, both Minneapolis Patrick Henry and Minneapolis North. Larry is a longtime community and youth advocate with 20-plus years of experience working with urban youth. His service to young people has earned him numerous awards and recognition, including CARE 11's 11 Who Care, KTCA's Everyday Hero, and the Minneapolis Park Board's Volunteer of the Year, as well as the Positive Image Father of the Year. In 2014, Larry McKenzie became the first African-American coach selected to the Minnesota Basketball Coaches Hall of Fame. As the Hoopheads podcast audience grows week by week, your five-star ratings and reviews help fuel our growth. Please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. When you do, the latest episodes will hit your phone as soon as they drop. Let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show and join the thousands of others who have become a part of Hoopheads Nation. Be prepared to listen and learn from our conversation with Coach Larry McKenzie from Minneapolis North Community High School in the state of Minnesota. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Minneapolis North Community High School, Larry McKenzie. Larry, welcome.
Thank you.
We are excited to be able to have you on and get a chance to dig into all the great things that you were doing in the game of basketball and helping kids. Want to start out by going back in time to when you were younger and just talk to me a little bit about your upbringing in the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with the game?
Well, that's a long, long time ago. however, you know, my recollection is, so I grew up in a basketball, what would be considered a basketball family. My dad was kind of a high school legend in Miami, Florida, played at Booker T. Washington High School. People always talked about his game. If your last name was McKenzie, when I was coming up, you played the game. So since I can remember probably about 7 or 8 years old, getting up in the morning, Saturday mornings, going up to the park, mainly outdoors, but always me and my dad shooting free throws, you know, working on my shot, you know, just kind of, you know, like father and sons do. I'm the oldest of four kids. What really kind of pushed me to the game, I think when I was about in sixth grade, around sixth grade, I got a chance to go to a high school basketball game to watch my uncle play, Stan McKenzie. And he was a pretty good player, went on to play at NYU. Played over in Italy for a year. Then he went to play for the Baltimore Bullets, played for the Phoenix Suns, Portland Trail Blazers, and ended his career with the Houston Rockets. So that always kept me going as I got older. I would spend my summers with my uncle. And so as he was getting ready for training camp, obviously I was doing a lot of basketball stuff and going to basketball camps.
So what was it about the game, other than obviously your family connection, what was it about the game itself? Was there one particular part of it that you were drawn to? At that time, were you excited about the X's and O's? Was there a piece of you that thought maybe someday I want to be a coach? Was it just purely the love of the game, getting out on the court, shooting, no, the relationships? What was it at that time when you were a kid?
No, I mean, I think it was just really the love of the game. One thing about basketball, you know, it's one of those sports where, you know, you can play by yourself. You can play one-on-one. You can play two-on-two, three-on-three. So, you know, some days you just pick up the ball, you go to the backyard. I mean, obviously back then, basketball, you know, on Saturdays, we saw all of the SEC basketball. On Sundays, we got our NBA basketball. But, you know, you could just go out in the yard. You could imagine. I was one of those kids that sat on my front porch and dreamed about playing in the NBA. For whatever reason, I always wanted to be a New York Knick. And so when I was growing up, I mean, every time I was out playing, I saw myself playing with, you know, at that time, Walt Frazier and Willis Reed and those guys, and later Earl of Pearl Monroe. But I was always a big New York Knicks fan.
Are you still a Knicks fan?
Nope. I've gotten past that. I guess, you know, it's funny. I was having this conversation the other day with my mom. I would say I'm a LeBron James fan. So, gotcha. You know, grew up in Miami. When he was there, I was a Heat fan. Went back to Cleveland, I was a Cleveland fan. You know, and I would say, so I was a big Magic Johnson fan. And my MJ is Magic Johnson. So, gotcha. Was a Laker fan, and now, again, a Laker fan.
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously we had LeBron here in Cleveland, and Jason and I have talked a lot about just how, I guess, grateful we are for him bringing such great basketball here for so many years, and obviously brought us an NBA championship that I think that somebody just turned 50 years old. I never would have thought that we would have gotten any championship at all. So the fact that he was able to bring us one was just a special thing. And obviously LeBron, a great, great player, and somebody who, if you're going to be a fan of somebody in the game today, I think that you think about somebody who plays the game the right way and as a coach, and somebody who respects, somebody who has a great basketball IQ. I think LeBron, of any player in the game today, and you think about Magic Johnson in the same way, guys who just saw things and angles and passes that other guys just didn't see. And I think that's what made those two guys special as basketball players for sure.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I mean, both of those guys, I mean, I always say, they do things that you can't necessarily teach, you know. And I guess the amazing thing for me, I mean, in particular, when people talk about, you know, the greatest of all time, I mean, Magic Johnson at 6'8", and again, LeBron, you know, at 6'8", you know, 240, 50 pounds, but his ability to handle the ball, to do the things that he do on the court, to me, is simply amazing.
Yeah, those two guys, and Magic clearly was the forerunner of what eventually sort of became guys that could handle the ball at all different sizes. And of course, now we've gone to where the NBA, you have this positionless sort of situation where guys, you know, need to be able to handle the ball and do multiple things and guard multiple positions. And, you know, Magic in his time was way ahead of the curve. As a 6'9 point guard, nobody had ever seen anybody that size to be able to command the floor the way he did and get up and down and run Showtime and hit Worthy and hit Byron Scott and Michael Cooper and Kareem and that whole group. You know, I grew up as a fan of the Showtime Lakers. I've had this conversation with Jason on the podcast before. We had to pick our favorite. We did an episode a week or so ago where we picked our favorite player from each NBA team. And I said there were four teams that I had a lot of difficulty with, and one of them was the Celtics, because I didn't like the Celtics back when they were going against Magic, and so I couldn't pick anybody from that era, and I continued to not like the Celtics. So I facetiously picked my favorite Celtic as Kyrie Irving, just because I couldn't bring myself to pick any of the Celtics that went against the Magic Lakers. Although I didn't like Larry Bird when I was a kid, I've grown to certainly appreciate him the older I've gotten, and how
talented he was. But I was always a Magic guy in the Celtics Lakers rivalry. It sounds like you were the same back in the day.
Without a doubt, yes.
All right. So as you keep moving on, you think about wanting to play in the NBA, and obviously that's a dream that lots and lots of kids have. Just talk about some of your fondest memories as a player. What are things when you think back to some of the best times, the best memories that you have in your playing career? What are things that come to mind for you when I say, give us your best memory?
Well, when you say that, I mean, I think about, so after, you know, once I was able to get to old enough to play organized basketball, I played for the boys club in Miami, and that group of guys, I mean, just the lifelong, you know, I mean, I still communicate with some of my teammates from doing that time. And so the friendships that I developed with that group of guys, I mean, and even though we would end up going to separate high school, I mean, those have been lifelong relationships for me. So, you know, I think about that. Then I ended up going to, I didn't attend my neighborhood high school. I went to Miami Beach Senior High. I think a lot of what I learned about the game, I thank my high school coach, Chuck Filson. The other thing, when I talk about relationships, I continue to, I mean, I on a regular basis, communicate with my teammates through social media. When I'm visiting places, whether that be Miami or Las Vegas or any place that I have a former teammate, I always make it a habit to make sure that we get together, that we have dinner. So, you know, it's been 30, 40 years, but these are, you know, some friendships that have stood the test of time. I think, and probably my fondest memory, there's two. I remember as a sophomore in high school, trying out, I was kind of in between being a JV player and a varsity player. And we had a couple guys who were really, really good, a couple guards by the name of Oscar Martinez and Cesar Ubay. And I knew that these guys got a lot of shots. So what I started to do, just kind of thinking ahead, kind of stuff that I heard my dad and uncle mention, I figured out that if I could just get five rebounds, so if they shot and missed, that I could get the ball, put it back five times, that would put me at 10 points and five rebounds a game. And as long, and I've always been one of the, I prided myself in being in the best shape. So with that, I kind of stood out. Coach recognized who I was. And I was able to get into the starting varsity lineup as a sophomore. Just because of my work ethic, and I was willing to play a role that most other guys didn't want to play. I mean, they wanted the ball, they needed to score, and I just figured out whenever they shot, I'd just get on the other side because I knew that they wouldn't shoot 100%. So that was my sophomore year. So that's a major memory for me too, just in terms of playing.
Have you shared that story, I'm sure, with players and teams that you've coached over the years? Because I think that's something that when I think about coaching a team and I think about dealing with kids, especially kids in today's world with social media and AAU and just the focus on getting to the next level and the different things that we know go on in the basketball world today, I think that there's relatively few kids who have learned that lesson that you described, which is you looked at the situation on your team. You tried to figure out what does my coach need or what does our team need in order for us to be successful and how can I fill that need so that I can get an opportunity to play. To me, there's a great lesson there that I'm sure you've used and I'm sure any coach could use to be able to tell kids, hey, look, you can get out on the floor. You may not be the leading scorer. You may not be able to take 15 shots in a game, but you can become a very, very valuable part of this team if you're willing to fill the role that we need you to fill in. So have you used that with your teams over the years as a coach?
Oh, I share that with my kids. I share that when I get an opportunity to talk to kids, you know, that are trying out for various teams all the time. I mean, and the other choice was, I mean, the year before I led my JV team and scoring, you know, at about 18 points a game. So I could have went back and been a leading scorer and on a JV squad, but you know, I had my goal that summer. I worked really hard I wanted to play varsity basketball, and so figured out a way to make that happen. And again, I mean, you know, I guess I recognized early on. I've always felt I was a little bit more mature than most kids for my age, and so I recognized early on that was a way for me to play. And interesting enough, I mean, the kid that I was competing against for that particular spot, I mean, he was one of those kids that, you know, even though we had two kids that were, you know, previously had been all city basketball players and was really, really good and being recruited at a high level, he thought he was going to come in and be a star right away. And of course that didn't happen. And so he ended up, I think, being like maybe the seventh or eighth guy that season. He was a junior playing on varsity, but you know, I was able to beat him out just because I was willing to accept the role and didn't need any plays ran for me or any of that kind of stuff. I, like I said, 5 rebounds a game. If I could put those back, you know, that's 10 points and 5 rebounds. Not too bad for a sophomore.
Not too bad at all. Not too bad at all. So I'm assuming that as you went on in your career, that your role expanded and you got to do a little bit more with the ball as you became a junior and senior.
Yeah, and actually, you know, my junior year, I was one of the leading scorers on the team. My senior year, I was the leading scorer on the team. And I tell you, one of the other great memories that I had my junior year, we lost, and I'll never forget it, we lost in the section finals against Michael Thompson and the great high school team that they had in Florida at Miami Jackson High School. You know, all 5-6 of those guys went on to play Division I basketball. And, of course, we know Michael Thompson would become the number one pick in the league and play, you know, have a Hall of Fame career in the NBA. But playing against him and actually having one of my better games that night, I think I had a double-double as a junior, 14 points, 10 rebounds. So that's probably another one of those great stories I like to share with the kids.
So while you're playing, is coaching at all on your radar? Is something that you're thinking about that at whatever point my coaching, my playing career comes to an end that I may want to coach, or was that something that came to you later? Because what we found is there's kind of two camps of coaches. There's some coaches that know right from the very beginning that, hey, I always know I want to coach. And there's other guys who get done playing or it's time to, quote, get a real job. And they think, man, I got to stay with the game of basketball that I love. So just talk to me a little bit about how you came to coaching and what it was about coaching that attracted you when it did.
Okay, so I have to tell you this story. So I grew up in a household with two educators. My mom was an elementary school teacher. My dad was a special ed teacher. And I tell people, never, ever in my wildest dreams that I ever thought I'd be working with kids. And so when I got out of college, I went into the insurance business. I was a salesman. I was trying to make as much money as I can. I mean, you know, I thought that was what I really, really wanted to do. I had a friend of mine by the name of Clyde Turner. Clyde is a legendary basketball player in the state of Minnesota, played for the Minnesota Gophers. Clyde is also probably was the first big guard in the Big Ten at 6'7". Playing for the University of Minnesota. He was a 6'7 point guard, played with Ron Behagen and all of those guys. And you probably, I don't know if you, well, you being in Cleveland, remember Luke Whitty and Ohio State and the big fight?
The big fight, absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So Clyde was one of the players during that time. But anyway, Clyde was working for Big Brothers. And so Clyde kept encouraging me to become a mentor of a and get involved with Big Brothers, in which he finally convinced me. And so I got involved with Big Brothers, and I got introduced to a young man by the name of Jules. And as Jules and I began spending time together, the thing that we discovered that we both had in common was a great love for the game of basketball. And so one day, believe it or not, Jules is walking through the hallway of his middle school, and he overhears the principal talking to some of the teachers saying that they probably wouldn't have a basketball team that season because they couldn't find anybody to volunteer to coach. and Jewel jumped into the conversation and he volunteered his big brother. That was my entree into coaching. And so I coached his team that year. We had some success. And I always tell people, the crazy thing is I got involved with coaching, looking to impact the life of a 13-year-old young man, and my life was forever changed. So it is because of Jules that I started coaching. I went on to coach a park board team, coached those kids for 6 years. When they went to high school, I went looking for a coaching position as a volunteer coach. But that was a life-changing moment for me when he volunteered me to coach his middle school team. And so that's how I got in.
What do you remember about standing in front of that group of kids for the very first time as their coach?
Well, the thing about it is the first – I guess I love the game. And so knowing a little bit about the game, I remember just jumping right in, you know what I'm saying, and try getting things organized and really just going back and reflecting on some of the things that I learned from my high school coach and my dad and the folks around me. So it really came pretty natural.
What was it about once you got into it? What did you like the most initially right out of the gate? What was it? Was it the relationships with the players? Was it the games? Was it the practices? Was it some specific aspect of coaching? What was it about it that made you say, hey, I want to come back and do this again?
You know what? Really, the probably for me, and I always tell people, for me, coaching has always been a ministry. And so what really probably was more exciting for me was the opportunity every day to talk about life lessons I was coaching a inner city kids. And so to be able to share with them how they could either use the game, allow the game to use them. But it was more having basketball as a tool to be able to mold and change lives. And I guess that's what I really, really found intriguing about the game. It was about building those relationships. A lot of those kids I became, not only coach, but like a surrogate father. So, and at that time, I didn't have any kids. So, I always tell, like I told Jules, I just kind of used him to experiment a little bit on what it would be like once I had kids.
Yeah, I think that's something that when I think about my own coaching journey, I think the fact that you were able to come to that realization early in your coaching career, and obviously you had already had that in you with being a big brother and all those things and the mentoring and that. I think it was already clearly an important part of your life and what you wanted to do. But I know for me, at least early on in my coaching career, it was more about the basketball and the X's and O's and maybe to some degree the relationships. But I don't think it was about using basketball as a vehicle to improve kids' lives. It was a vehicle for me to improve kids' ability to play basketball and to help their team to be more successful. And the things that you were just talking about are things that didn't come to me or didn't become apparent to me until I was older, certainly than what you were at the time. So I think that that's something that if you look at the totality of your coaching career, I'm sure that you've continued to build on your ability to teach those life lessons through the game. And so just tell me a little bit about how you go about incorporating that into what you do day to day now as a high school coach when you're teaching life lessons. Is that something that you intentionally sit down and think about when you're putting together a practice plan, or is it more looking for the opportunity of teachable moments to be able to jump in and something happens and you say, oh, here's an opportunity that I can demonstrate to my kids how this applies outside of their life? Just talk about your process for using basketball to teach life lessons.
Well, so it's all of the above. So for me, one of the things that I do that I've been doing since I've been a high school coach, a lot of it starts with my own personal mantra or creed that I use every day. And so it's something that I share with my kids. We do it before practice. Every single day we do it before games. It's the foundation of everything that we do. My creed, it goes like this. And so I've changed it wherever I've been. You know, was the Patriot Creed, Stars Creed, now it's the Polar Creed. But it's something that I do every single day. I start my day with this. It goes like this. This is the beginning of a new day. I have been blessed with this day to use as I will. I can waste it or use it for good. For what I do today is important. I'm exchanging a day of my life for it. I must decide, good or bad, gain or loss, success or failure, in order that I never regret the price that I pay for it. So along with the creed, every single day, I choose a motivational quote that we begin with. So we have what I call the thought of the day. Then we do our creed. But also in our program, I mean, so it's a highly structured program with mandatory study hall 3 days a week. So we spend 3 days a week, 1 hour with academics, and then we do life skills. And so I use chess. We use yoga. We have speakers come in. We talk about leadership. But I incorporate all of those things. And one of the things I have to say is, you know, and kind of skipping through my career, I was a talented athlete, but I had some personal challenges around some anger issues as I was coming through in high school and in college. And so when I really got to the stage of coaching, I kind of looked back and saw what I thought was God had actually prepared me along the way to coach the kids who I was. One of the things I say is that Larry McKenzie, like Coach McKenzie, could have never played for Larry McKenzie. you know, I I'll be honest. I mean, I was one of those kids because I was talented. You know, some coach often, you know, would say, well, McKenzie, you feel like you want to practice today? Or, you know, so I got away with a lot of stuff that I don't know was in my best interest because I was a fairly talented athlete. But it also cost me in my recruiting, even though I was talented, had some Division I offers, I ended up going to NAIA school in Wisconsin. Didn't play for 4 years. I only played 2 years before I ended up just being a part of the intramural squad because I couldn't get along with the coach. I wasn't a good teammate, any of those kind of things. And so as a coach, I've been able to take some of my own personal shortcomings. And I always tell people, I think it's important that you share your movie. And so it's just been one of those things that I do with my kids. But it's when you talk about life lessons, I mean, I literally, you know, look every single day, kind of go into looking for an opportunity to talk about things that are going on in the community, maybe going on in the school, but things that are going to impact them and, on and off the basketball court.
Yeah, I love that you're able to use your own story and use your own flaws to be able to impact kids and tell your story. I think that's something that is really underrated when it comes to being a good coach, is being human, being vulnerable, and letting kids know that you're not perfect. And as we all know, it's far better if you can learn from someone else's mistakes than learn from your own. If you can avoid the mistakes that somebody else has made because you've had a conversation with them and you've had a relationship with them, I think that ends up really speaking to the kids directly. And so I think by you sharing those flaws that you had when you were a player, I think you're better able to get that message across. And I'm sure the kids in your program take that to heart when they hear it from you as their coach standing in front of them, that, hey, I'm not perfect. I did some things when I was younger that maybe I look back on them and I wish I'd have handled it differently. And I think those first person accounts can definitely help kids to grow and learn and get better and improve. So I like how you talked about your creed, and I think that that's something that, wow, that's a powerful statement that you put out there. When you think about it in terms of, you know, what you're spending for that day of your life, I'm sure that that has an impact on you every morning when you get up, and I know it has an impact on your kids. Talk about when you got your first high school head coaching job and what that was like and how you improved from your first opportunity to be a head high school coach to the point where you are now. Give us some things that, boy, when you look back, you weren't very good at first that you've gotten a lot better at over the years.
So I think early on, I actually got a high school job. I went in my first year as a volunteer assistant coach. Met the coach in church. Told him I had been coaching some young guys. Were looking to get into high school coaching. Did he have any openings on the staff? He said, well, you know, you could come and help. I can't afford to pay you. So at the time, I had time on my hands. As I said, I was working in corporate America. I was making a pretty good living. So I ended up volunteering 1 year, built a relationship with those kids. It was a program, ended up having major impact. He ended up getting a position to go to Dayton, Ohio to become a youth pastor. And the kids all walked into the AD office and said, we want you to hire Coach McKenzie. So never interviewed for the position. AD said, if you want the job, it was yours. So I always tell folks that was the beginning, and the rest has been kind of history. But I'll tell you early on, I was one of those guys who even with my assistant coaches, wasn't very flexible. It was, you know, my way or the highway, that kind of thing. I think I was like crazy stuff when I look back now. Like, I didn't allow the kids to play music in the locker room. You know, I just had all of these rules and different kind of things. And as I look back, I've learned as a coach, you got to be what you want. You know, you got to be what you want to see. And so, therefore, being a much better listener, I think I've learned to incorporate and use my assistant coaches a lot better than I did in my early years. I think the other thing of it is, too, is, you know, as I got older and I had my own kids, I also learned to pick my battles. You know what I'm saying? Like, not making a big deal out of everything that a kid does, just kind of knowing, learning that you can't coach every kid the same, that you have some kids that you need to wrap your arms around and give them a hug, and then there's some kids that you can really get into, and that's the way that they're going to respond. So I see so much growth. And here's the other thing I'll tell you, even as more recently as the last couple years, I always consider myself as somebody who I would say, you know, I talked a lot about empowerment and empowering my staff and empowering my kids. But I kind of started doing some, you know, self-reflecting. And what I discovered is I would tell them, try empower them, but I always also told them how to do it. And if it wasn't done my way, I had an issue. So as I look back, I was like, I had a real trust problem. And so what I've grown now is a couple years ago, I just kind of started letting my assistant coaches, you know, if I gave them something, if they made a mistake, it was okay. And then we talked about it and got to the point, it didn't have to be done exactly the way I've done it or the way I would have done it. And over the last couple years, I've just seen our staff come together and be a lot closer. And I've also seen my coaches just flourish in that, you know, taking on things, not waiting to be asked, all of those kind of things, because I've learned to trust them. And I don't think I had a lot of trust, even with players, you know what I'm saying? Making mistakes, especially when you have talent, it's easy to snatch a kid for turnover and those kind of things. So I think over the years, I've grown through those kind of things in terms of becoming a better coach.
Yeah, I love what you said about empowering your assistants. And I think that that's something that I can definitely relate to. I think people who are driven and are ambitious and want to have success, I think that those types of people tend to be very control-oriented. And because you have such high expectations for yourself and what those outcomes are going to be, you want to make sure that it's done exactly the way that you want it to be done. And I know that for myself, whenever I have to delegate something, it's difficult. It's hard to let go of that control and let somebody else, as you said, do it. And maybe they do it in a slightly different way than I would have done it. But there's no possible way that you can get to the level that you want to get to, whether it's in coaching or business or whatever it is that you do in life, if you try to do every single thing yourself. There's no way to manage a high school basketball program all by yourself. You have to have people that you can trust and that you can empower. And so I think that's the message that I take away from your story. And I think it's a great one for coaches out there, especially coaches who are maybe new to the profession, who are just taking over their first job as a high school coach. I think it's really important that you empower your staff and that you give them responsibility. And then, as you said, people, if you have the right people in those positions, they're going to flourish and they're going to come through and they're going to start doing things that maybe you didn't even realize they could do or that you didn't expect them to do. And that's when you know you really have something. And I'm going to follow up that little statement with a question for you. And that is, when you're putting together your staff and you're going to go out and you have an opening and you're conducting interviews, if it's not somebody that you already know that you've kind of pinpointed for the position, but you're looking for someone new, what are some of the qualities that you look for in a good assistant coach at this point in your program?
So I'll tell you my number one criteria. I always tell people, I've never hired anybody because of their X's and O's. What I look for, in particular, the majority of my career has been spent coaching in the inner city with African-American boys. And so number one thing, I want someone that has shown a history of being committed to kids. Not somebody that, and when I say committed, not somebody that think they're going to be able to just show up in November and be done in March, or somebody who shows up for 2 hours of practice and think that's the end of what we have to do. So I've looked for people that have a history of working in education, but who've been involved as mentors or you know, some role working with kids and showing a high level of commitment of going above and beyond. So that's my number one criteria when I'm looking for someone on my staff. I figure, you know, with all the camps and clinics and all of those kind of things, I mean, if you truly, you know, like basketball, we can get you those things. But I can't get you to, you know, be committed to the level that we need you to be committed in our program. Going back to the things that you were talking about, I mean, if you got a high level of standards, if excellent is your standard, then I need somebody to be committed to that and willing to do the things that that's going to make that happen. So that's my number one criteria.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that when you think about hiring an assistant, or you think about somebody who's part of your staff, or you think about just yourself as a basketball coach, there's a lot of things that you have to get right. And there's a lot of things that have to be a part of it. Being committed, I think, is critical. And I think you made another good point when you said that the X's and O's piece is something that you can teach people. As you said, especially in today's world, where pretty much any coach that you want to find is accessible and amenable to having a conversation with you, you can go online and search and watch videos and find plays and do all those things. And if you, as you said, are interested in the game of basketball, you're going to be motivated to go out and find all those things. And you can figure that part of it out. It's the people part of it that I think is the key to making sure that you get it right, that you find a coach who's committed to building relationships with the players on your team, building relationships with the other coaches on the staff, building relationships with the school community. And then, as we talked about a few minutes ago, that coach has to also buy into your philosophy of being willing to impart life lessons to the players. And if they can do that, then I think you found the right person. And so, as a head coach, how much do you find, or how much do you take responsibility for helping to develop your assistants if they have the desire sometime to become a head coach? What's your role in helping to develop your assistants? There are some coaches, obviously, that are happy being an assistant and may not want to advance in their career. But if you do have someone who eventually wants to take over their own program, what do you feel are your responsibilities to help that coach to be able to get to that level where they can take over their own program someday?
So I mean, in a simple way of answering that question, I always get it wrong, but I think it was Napoleon Hill or Napoleon Stone. One, but I once read someplace that having knowledge without sharing it is like having an atomic bomb and never dropping it. And so for me, I want my kid, my coaches, you know, to be able to pick my brain. I have a couple young guys. I take them to all the meetings that I go to with administrators. I want them to learn what it's like to do the bus schedule. But the crazy for me, and this has been the blessing that I've had, you know, so this is year 22 for me as a high school coach. I have one of my assistants that's been with me for 20 years who's more than capable of running his program. My associate head coach, the current position that I have, he was the head coach. The school was having some challenges. He stepped down so that I could become the head coach and became my assistant coach so that we could turn the basketball program around and basically save Minneapolis North High School through athletics, getting kids to come in through enrollment. But my staff, I got a couple new people that I brought in this year. So they were with us 1 year. But the majority of my staff has been with me for 10 years or more.
How important is that from a continuity standpoint? How does that help you? I can answer that. I was an assistant coach with the same staff. We had the exact same staff for, I believe, 11 or 12 years. Same head coach, same varsity assistant coach, same JV coach, same freshman coach. We were all together, and it just really worked well. We felt like year after year, that continuity just gave us such an advantage. So talk a little bit about how your comfort level with those guys that you've been with for such a long time, talk about how that impacts your program and really helps you to sustain your success year after year.
Well, I think the biggest thing of it is, and you know this, Coach, is it's so important that from the ninth grade level through the varsity level that you all are speaking the same language. So, you know, the kids are hearing, you know, the same plays that you're talking about, out-of-bound plays and all of those things, defenses all the same. I think that's critical. But the thing for me, what it does, it really allows me to continue to grow and do some other things because, you know, like with my coaches, I could be running late with a meeting. And when I walk in the gym, I know right no matter where. They know what we would be doing at that particular time. I jump right in on the practice plan. It doesn't change. I mean, I don't know if you can get a smoother kind of operation, but also I like the thing that I think is critical is, you know, we have to be coaches, so the coaching staff have to be a team, and we got to model the behavior of the team. And so I like the longevity of our staff because I also know that even if I'm not around, that my staff is messaging the same thing the same way. And it's funny because my JV coach is one of my former players who've now been with me for 8 years. And I mean, I'll sit behind a bench, and if I close my eyes, I think I'm hearing Coach McKenzie, you know, and so that could be a good thing and a bad thing. But it's just like I said, I've been blessed. It's a well-oiled machine. And I think it's one of the reasons that, you know, we've been blessed. Like, you know, this group, you know, I came into a situation where my assistant, my head is associate coach. He had this position. As I said, he stepped down. He had won 3 games in 3 years. The school was down to 68 kids. And he sought me out to come and take the position. We've been city conference champ the last 7 years in a row. We had, you know, 6 Division I kids. I mean, 2 state titles. And I think it's because of the continuity of the staff.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoop Heads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store. We had recently just had Mono Watts on from PGC Basketball, and one of the things we talked to him about was building a culture. And he said something to us that totally just reminds me of what you're describing, and that was that one of the most difficult things for him in building PGC Basketball was when it was small, he was at every single event. He was at every single camp. And he said what he had to do is he had to be able to figure out how to make the culture exist even when he as the leader wasn't there. So if he wasn't at a camp, there had to be no difference in that camp, whether he was there or not. And what I hear you saying is basically the same thing, that if you're late for practice for whatever reason, for a meeting, or if you're sitting on the bench behind the JV team, you're hearing and seeing and your staff and your players are doing the same things that they would be doing whether you're there or not. And to me, that's really the definition of what a great culture is, because as we all know, as present as you might be as the head coach, there are moments where you can't be there. You can't be at every moment in the locker room. You can't be in the hallways at school. You can't be with those kids, with their families, in the community every single moment. And so when you built the type of culture through the people that you have and through the way that you've set up your program and through the life lessons that you've taught, when you've taught that culture to the point where you don't need to be there in order for the culture to be present, man, that's when you've really accomplished something. It sounds like that's when what you've been able to do. So can you talk about what did you do? What was the turnaround to go from winning 3 games in 3 years? What was it that you think you were able to do well that enabled you to turn the program around to the point where you're a perennial winner?
I think going back to what you just said, I mean, is early on. And so I went into a situation. So when I went into the school, we only had 68 kids we had two classes, a freshman class and a sophomore class. And so I think everything had to start with our coaching staff modeling the type of behavior that he wanted. But also, I can tell you, I don't think there's anything more important in terms of building your culture than your locker room. And so one of the things that I immediately done is, you know, we told our kids that they were going to have to be student athletes. And if you didn't take care of business in the classroom, you were not going to be able to represent the school and community by wearing a Minneapolis North jersey. And so we set those systems in place. And one of the things that I always tell our kids, so I said, if I could change your mind, I could change your life. And so we just talk about learning to believe. And so every single day, and I want to go back to my high school. And there's some words that my point guard, Oscar Martinez, told me as a sophomore in high school. I'll never forget the day, one of those days when I just didn't feel like giving 100%. And, you know, him being the leader of that squad, he came to me and he said, "Mac, let me just tell you something. If you're not going to give 100%, don't tighten up those shoes and don't step across that line." And so for me as a coach, every single day, when I put on my shoes and I walk into that gym, it's about giving 100%. And that starts with the coaches. And what I tell the kids, if I give 100%, my expectation is you're going to give 100%. And so that's a culture that we built, And I'm not one of these guys that do a lot of, you know, killers and all of those kinds of things. We create an expectation. I always say what we do is not for everybody. And if you value being a part of this family, then you're going to follow the rules and expectations that we have as a family. And so to me, it's creating that kind of a culture that have allowed us to win and have the success that we have.
I love what you just said, which is it has to start with you as the head coach. And I think that that goes to something that we've probably all heard this before, but I think it's applicable right here with what we're talking about. And that is that you can talk to kids all you want about how important it is to work hard or whatever your cultural values are and the pillars of your program. And you can talk about those things as much as you want. But if you're not living those things on a daily basis and you're not demonstrating those things with your actions or with your words, those kids aren't going to buy into what you're trying to sell them, because the words that you say don't mean anything if they're not backed up by action. And I think when your program, that goes your assistants, your players, the people in the school, and they see that you're 100% committed, that you're doing the things that you say you're going to do, then that builds the kind of trust that's required in order to be able to build the type of culture that it takes in order to be successful at whatever it is that you're going to do. That could be in business, that could be in coaching, that could be in any walk of life. You've got to walk the walk first before you can talk the talk. And if all you're going to do is talk the talk, you're not going to have much success.
Especially these days, though, because I think kids recognize that, you know, I mean, kids know, recognize that right away. And you're absolutely right. One of the things I tell my coaches all the time, kids don't care what you say. They watch what you do. And so we're very conscious. And when I tell our coaches, I mean, I always use this thing. I don't want my coaches to be role models. I want them to be real models. And so know that our kids, you know, they're watching the way that you approach practice. They're watching how you talk to your kids. They're watching how you treat your wife. And all, at all times, you have to be conscious that this is what we signed up for. And so one of the things, you know, I always say this even to our kids, when you join a team, you're giving up you. And so I use this thing all the time every year with the kids to remind them that, you know, if something was to happen, if I was to go out and, you know, get intoxicated and hit somebody, the headlines wouldn't say Larry McKenzie. It would say Minneapolis North head boys basketball coach. And so I've given a lot of me up to be a part of this program. And so I just tell our coaches, we have to be real models and not role models. And that's taking it to the next level.
Absolutely it is. And I think there's no substitute for that. As you said, the action speaks far louder than the words. And kids today, they know it. I always say that kids can sense when you're not genuine. Kids can sense when you're trying to cut corners. And if you do, you're not going to last very long in a coaching profession, because kids are pretty good at sniffing out people who aren't telling them the truth.
In a heartbeat.
All right. So let's go and talk a little bit about how you go about putting together a practice plan. So what does your practice planning look like? How long does it take you? Where do you do it? When do you do it? How do you organize a practice for coaches out there who are maybe struggling to figure out, how do I put together a good, effective high school practice? Just give us the procedure that you use to put together your practices.
So I'm going to tell you, for me, my planning starts after the last game in March. So typically, you know, my season, I would say, goes through the end of the Final Four. After the one signing moment, you know, I try to take a little time for myself. But then I begin the process. And so initially, it's going back and looking at, you know, games or things that happened last season. It starts with my postseason meeting with my coaches. And then I always say I start in September and October putting together what I call the puzzle. So what I do is, on a sheet of paper, I'm going to write down what I want to do man-to-man offensively, right? So I want to put in swing. I want to put in motion. I want to put in these various sets. And so I write all of those down. Then I'm going to spend some time talking, okay, so I want to play man-to-man defense, but I also want to do some run and jump. I want to put in a diamond press. I want to put in a 1-2-2, a 1-3-1. So I write all of my defenses down, right? Then I start thinking about, okay, how effective was my out-of-bound play, my sideline out-of-bounds, my baseline out-of-bounds, all of those kind of things, you know, looking at my personnel. So I call it putting together the puzzle. And so I start with a master practice plan. writing down everything that I want to do. And then for me, I use, so November and December, it's a 2-hour practice. January, it's a hour and a half. February, it's an hour and a half, and then I kind of go down to an hour. By the time we get to March, it's a 45-minute practice. And so I look at that, and I put together that plan. So what do I need? It's the early part of the season. So I always tell people, if you watch my team, we'll never be the same team in November that we are in March. And so I'm gonna spend the beginning of the season. So I'm going to break out my practice schedule. So I usually, if I'm going 2 hours, I'm going to have about 45 minutes offense, 45 minutes defense. Then I'm going to have what I call special teams or sideline out of bounds, special plays, last second stuff, all of those kinds of things. And I practice everything. I'm one of these guys at the beginning of the season. I practice how my kids, I want my kids to run out of the locker room. I practice what we're going to do in warm-up. I have my kids sit on the bench the way I want them to sit during timeouts. I go every single year. We just go back to the very, very basic. And I put all of those things in my practice schedule. And so what can I get in 2 hours in my 45 minutes of offense? So I'm going to start with my basic motion offense. I'm going to start building my man-to-man defense. And I just add something all the way through, and I'm looking at that master schedule on a daily basis as I'm putting together my daily schedule. So I'm looking at those things that we've done, what we haven't gotten to, whether or not there's some things I want to eliminate. But that is my process in building my practice schedule.
So if you put together your practice schedule and you start thinking about, again, breaking it down into what your drills are for this particular offense or this particular set that you want to run and that kind of thing. How do you keep track of your drills, your sets, your sideline, baseline, out of bounds? What's your process for keeping those things together? Obviously in the olden days, lots of guys had a 3-ring binder. Today, lots of people have files on their computer. What do you use to keep track of the things that you want to include on a daily practice plan?
So this is crazy, right? But I guess you talk about, I guess I'm stuck in the olden days because even as of today, I mean, so part of the last couple of weeks, I've been taking all of my practice plans, put them in a 3-year binder.
Old school, Larry. I like it.
So in my garage on the top shelf is 20 years of binders. So to be honest with you, I can go back. It's crazy because I can go pull the binder and say, what did I do on practice number 4 at this school this year? Look at what we did, that year. And so I kind of look at all of that kind of stuff when I'm putting together that master schedule to see what I need to change. And then you got to look at personnel, too, So, like, you may have a group of kids that, some are more athletics than others. I can do more pressing. Well, maybe with this this group, we got to spend more time just working on the basic of our man-to-man, defense and those kind of things. And so, but all of that, yeah, so I look at all of that. But I'm an old-school guy, so they're all in 3-year band. I haven't gotten to that far yet in terms of getting them on the computer.
I like it. I think that there's a lot of good things about having stuff on the computer, but there's also something to be said for having a piece of paper or something physical in front of you. There's a lot of times where, as good as the computer and the technology is, there's times where it's nice just to look at an old school book or an old school 3-ring binder and be able to flip through it and actually feel what you have in front of you instead of just staring at it on a screen. So I can definitely relate to what you're saying there with the old fashioned 3-ring binder. Let me ask you this about
Real quick. So I also I write my practice plan every day. And at the end of practice, just going back to, being inclusive of my assistant coaches. So I do have one of my coaches that I consider like an offensive coordinator. I have one I consider a defensive coordinator. And I always ask them at the end of practice, is there anything you want to, put more of an emphasis on tomorrow as we come back? And so I'll put that in to the practice plan every day. But I literally, like clockwork, I mean, we practice. So study hall starts at 3:30. I write my practice plan 3:15 every day.
So how long? So they have a 1 hour study hall. That's immediately following the school day.
Yeah. So we actually have we practice from 3:30. We have a 2 hour, 1 hour study hall, and then 1 hour is life skills. So okay. The first hour you're getting all of your academics out of the way. And then, like I say, the second hour, we're teaching them how to play chess or doing yoga in the weight room or leadership. This year we use John Gordon's curriculum training camp. And so we would have a lesson, you know, once a week out of John Gordon's book on training camp. So
how did that go? Did you like that? Did that go well?
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. I've become a big John Gordon fan.
Yeah, he puts out a lot of great stuff. His books, I love the books because they're so simple to understand and you can get through them so quickly, and yet the messages are so powerful in his books.
Yeah, and the kids loved it too. So,
all right, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you engage the parents of your players in your program, because I know that's one of the things, as you talk to coaches at all levels of the game, that parents, more so today in the year 2020 than has ever been true in the past, parents are obviously involved, invested in their child's athletic career. So we know they're going to be around, and it's important to be able to get them on board, to be able to engage with them, to be able to help them understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish with their son or their daughter and your program. So talk a little bit about what you do to engage the parents of your players in your program.
So we have a parent handbook that we distribute at the beginning of the season. And what that talks about is, you know, particularly for the freshmen that are coming in, we talk about how high school basketball is different from travel or park board and what the expectations are. We give them the practice schedule in there. And all of our kids and their parents have to sign a contract. So what the expectations are. So we give them up front. And then part of that, one of the things, I don't allow parents in practice. So, we do have occasions where we open it up to parents, all parents, but I don't allow parents to sit around. I tell them that they have to, notify me if they want to, show up at practice, but we have a closed practice policy. Also, in a joking manner, each year I tell kids I was blessed. I've raised two kids who are fairly successful. Both of my kids played Division I basketball. And so I tell the parents in that parent meeting that I will agree not to tell you how to raise your kid, your son, if you agree not to tell me how to run my basketball program. And if we do that, we'll get along just fine. I think I have some pretty good parenting skills, but I'll keep my advice to myself as long as you keep your basketball advice to yourself. And I've been blessed. I mean, I don't, I also have a 24-hour rule, no contact after a game in regards to anything. I stole something from Jay Billis. If you want to have a meeting, I'm open to meetings, but if you want to have a meeting and you're going to come in and talk about somebody else's kid, we have to invite that kid and their parents into the meeting, and you have to say what you want to say in front of that kid and their parents. That's never happened, so I don't have a lot of meetings. But so I put all of those things in place.
So if you do have a situation where a parent wants to come in and have a discussion with you about playing time, what are the ways, or what are some of the things that you would talk about to explain to the parent why their son isn't playing maybe as much as they feel that their son should be playing? Just talk with me a little bit about how those conversations, how do you like to handle those particular conversations? Because they're obviously ones that every coach out there faces on a semi-regular basis.
Yep. So in part of that parent handbook is it's a kind of a three-step process. One, I ask them if there's an issue, you know, because we're trying to help your son grow as a young man. We ask that he come in and advocate on his own behalf. If he doesn't feel satisfied, then I will sit down with myself, and I always include one of my assistant coaches or our staff in those meetings. And to be honest with you, I always start off with this. So, you know, you tell kids, I mean, obviously playing time is something that you earn, you know, and, you know, we've offered all of these opportunities. And I always tell every kid and every parent, I want you to start this meeting off this way. Coach, I've done everything you've asked me to do, and I want to know why I'm not playing. And if we can't start there, you know, I mean, in terms of, you know, have you asked someone to put up extra shots? Have you asked the coach to come in early in the morning? Did you get your 10,000 shots up? You know, when the other kids were in the weight room, where were you? Those kind of things. If we can't start with those conversations, then you know why you're not playing. But I want to sit down and I want to hear the kid or the parent out. And usually, I mean, when I've had to have those kind of conversations, I can't think of any time that the parents, and it's usually mainly the dads, you know, who kind of living through their kids, but they usually understand, you know what I'm saying? So I'm a big stickler on defense, and I'll go to the point of having one of my assistant coaches, if I know that I'm meeting with Joe Smith, I want you to pull up all of Joe's turnovers or his defensive possession a couple nights ago as to why he didn't play. And so I'll sit down and have a film session with him, help them understand what I was looking for.
Yeah, and I think that's important for kids to be able to understand. I think sometimes this is where parents, there's maybe a disconnect in the communication sometimes, I think, between parents and players. Because I think the reality is in 99% of the cases where there's a conflict about playing time, I think deep down the player knows why they're not playing. And sometimes they just have a difficult time having that conversation with their parent. And so there's a disconnect between the parent and the kid. And then the parent comes in with one point of view, but the kid, if you could inject him with truth serum, the kid could probably tell the parent why they're not playing in most cases, I'm guessing.
I agree with you. I think I think almost in all cases, like, and I say that, I mean, the kid knows when they go home, but it's hard when you're sitting at a dinner table. And, you know, the thing about the game is this, we all know, like, you know, when you get home, I mean, I'm sure our parents did the same thing. I mean, nobody talks about, you know, how many times little James or Johnny dove on the floor for a loose ball, or or, you know, he boxed out, or he held the other team's you know, best player to 2 points. You know, when you're talking to your uncle or your neighbor or whatever, it's wow, you only had 2 points last night. What happened? And so, you know, if you didn't score, you know, then I mean, and most times, I mean, when parents are coming in, even when they're talking about playing time, it's not really about how much they play. It's about how many points their son is scoring.
I think that's really true. I couldn't agree with you more on that, because if the kid is on the floor for 30 out of 32 minutes, but they're not getting the number of shots that the parent thinks they should get, then at that point, the playing time piece of it becomes irrelevant. It's almost like it's just this hierarchy of, if I'm not playing, I want to play a little bit. If I'm playing a little bit, I want to play a lot. If I'm playing a lot, I want to get more shots. And in theory, that's a good thing. If the player is continuing to aspire to get better and increase their role, I think that's really, really important. But you just have to make sure that there's not a disconnect between what's expected and what, you know, what the coach's expectation of the player's role is and what the player or the parent's expectation of that role can be. And I think sometimes where, as I said before, that lack of communication between player and parent can sometimes make it a challenge. And so I guess my follow-up question to this situation is, obviously not every kid on your team is going to get to be the leading scorer and take the most shots on the team. And you're going to have kids that either A, have to play a smaller role than other kids, and you're also going to have kids at the back end of your roster that aren't going to play very much. So how do you keep those kids engaged? How do you keep them buying into the culture? What do you do to make sure that the kids who are not the stars of the team, the kids who are not getting those opportunities that everybody in the public sees, how do you keep those kids engaged and keep them feeling like valuable members of your team?
So one of the things that we do as a staff is, so every year we begin our season, we do what we call a team retreat. At that retreat, usually, I mean, we sit down as a team. And one of the things I do is I have all of the kids go up to the whiteboard and I have them write down, you know, what's your personal goal for the year? How many points you want to score? How many points, you know, rebounds you want to get? How many assists you want to average? And you have, you know, I keep anywhere from 13 to 15 kids. So you have 15 kids go up the board. You know, everybody, you know, of course, you got the one guy who wants to average 20. And then, you know, even the guys who are not going to play, they want to get 10 and, you know, 5 assists. And so what I do is I add it all up. And if all of you guys did what you say we're going to do, we'll average 220 points a day. do you think that's realistic? And so we really sit down and say, we kind of break it down. You know, here's kind of what the pecking order. And I honestly, so what I've done over the last few years, I have a couple kids. So in addition to captains, I call them my bench captains. And so their job is to, you know, keep the team engaged, keep the bench engaged, those kind of things. Like, and so I'm honest with some of our kids, like the best way that you're going to help this team is in practice, helping the guy that you're guarding get better every day. Some of you guys are going to, you know, we're going to give you minutes when we can. But you know, we're going to need you to really, be the keepers of the team spirit. One of the things I constantly say, because, you know, I mean, injuries and things happen. And I'm reminding my kids at various points during the year, you know, the worst thing that could happen, and one of the things my mentor used to say to me often is, one of the worst things that could happen is for the opportunity to come and present itself and you not be ready. And you not be ready. And so we just, I'm talking all the time that everybody matters from 1 through 15. 1 through 15, everybody has a job to do. And, you know, your job could change. But when you're talking about life lessons and those kind of things, we spend a lot of time incorporating those kind of things into our daily discussion about roles. You know what I'm saying? And even, you know, I talk about being a family a lot. And so for me, you know, I'm kind of like the father of the household. My assistant coaches, they're the uncles. Everybody has a different role to do. And so, you know, if we you're only as strong as your weakest link. So if we do our jobs as a collective, from the top to the bottom, then we'll be successful. And ultimately, it's about our four goals every year. And that is being conference champs, Twin Cities champs, section champ, and state champs. And that's what really matters.
Yeah, I think when you're having those conversations on a daily basis with kids and you're able to demonstrate that they are valued and you keep communicating that, I think that's when you have success. I know that I've seen, and it's happened in programs that I've been involved with, sometimes as a player, sometimes as a coach, where those bench players get neglected is maybe too strong of a word, but they just don't get the attention from the coaching staff that the players who are out on the floor a lot are getting. And that makes it really difficult to continue to keep those kids at the end of the bench engaged. And I think by what I hear you saying is, A, you help to define the roles for those kids and help them to understand that even though they might not be contributing 12 points a game out on the floor on Friday night, that their contributions are valued. And then you're doing that on a daily basis and you're reinforcing it and you're letting them know that you see them and that they're valued. And a lot of times I think that's something that doesn't happen. And when it does, those kids at the end of the bench, although it's tough and we all know that they want to be able to be out there and they want to be able to contribute out on the floor during games. I think when they see that their contributions are being recognized by the coaching staff, that makes such a difference in their attitude, and consequently that also permeates through the rest of the team, because it's very easy, as we know, all it takes is one or two kids to get disgruntled and start talking about things, and you can very, very easily upset what previously have been a great locker room by having one or two kids that start getting upset and not feeling like they're valued.
No question about it. And that's why I say the locker room is the most important thing. But the other thing that I do, I mean, and when you have a staff like ours who've been around, so as my coaches are running various drills, I make it a habit every single practice to touch every kid 20 to 30 seconds. How was your day in school? How are things going? Keep working hard. You're doing this. I'm seeing you. So, I'm just every kid, when I get a chance, I'm standing by a different kid. I'm having a, you know what I'm saying? So I'm not just spending my time with my leading scorer or my top rebounder. Every single day, I use my assistant coaches in a way that allows me to have, some personal time with every kid in our program and practice.
Yeah, I think that's critically important. I think of the same thing. If you think about what an effective teacher does, it's very similar. In the classroom, teachers got to get around and get to know every single student. You can't just focus your attention only on the kids who put their hand up and are always answering questions. You got to find the quiet kid in the back in the corner, and you got to figure out a way to engage that kid. And when you do, like you said, sometimes it only takes 20 or 30 seconds a day to just check in. Hey, how you doing? Anything going on? And maybe you notice something different about the kid's behavior during practice, good or bad. And then you get a chance to go over and say, hey, what's going on today? Tell me about what's happening at home, or tell me about what was going on at school today. And as you get to know your kids better, you start to get a read for that. And I think it's all about that daily contact, as you said. And it could be as little as 20 or 30 seconds. It could be a 15-minute sit-down conversation. It could be a quick text. Who knows? But regardless, when you're having that touch with kids every single day, to me, that makes a huge, huge difference. All right, I want to ask you two more things as we start coming close to the end of our time. And that is, number one, let's start out with this one. What is your biggest challenge that you find day to day of being a high school coach in the year 2020? What is the thing that you find to, I don't know if struggle with is the right way to say it, but what's the most challenging aspect do you feel of being a high school coach in your day-to-day life?
You know what? I mean, to be honest with you, for me is I honestly think at times that the rest of the people or other folks that are in the building don't understand the importance of athletics and the impact that we have as coaches on kids, that for some reason, when the kids come into the gym, that is my classroom, but it's not always looked upon as that. I coach in an urban community, and then just the resources, being able to provide my kids with the same things that some of their suburban counterparts may have, or just, last year I had 5 homeless kids. So, there are days that I wish I could just walk in and I could simply be a basketball coach. But I guess to answer your question, that the biggest challenge is that people not understanding all of these other hats that we have to wear, whether we want to or not.
And I think, and I'm guessing that for you, based on your past, based on our conversation of what's important to you, that you almost look at those challenges then as things that are, if you flip it around, those are things that almost become a mission for you, that we've got to overcome these challenges. It's so important that we are there for those kids who are homeless. We're there figuring out a way that we can fundraise or get the resources that we need to be able to build the kind of program that we have that the kids that are part of your program deserve to have, and that you want to be able to provide them with everything that anybody else has. And so I can see where if people within your school setting aren't valuing what you're doing on the same level, and they don't think of your gymnasium as a classroom, I can definitely see where trying to overcome that could be a challenge that would drive you. And based on what I know about you and the two conversations that we've had, I'm guessing that that's something that fuels your fire every single day, which leads me into my next question, which is, when you get up in the morning, what is your biggest joy? What's the thing that, when you think about being a high school basketball coach, what is the thing that gets you out of bed, gets you smiling and saying, I can't wait to get to my job today? What is it about coaching that you love?
Well, I mean, you pegged me correctly. You know, it does fuel my fire and becomes a challenge, and we try to make it happen. But I think, I always say this, I think, you know, Billy Graham says a coach will impact more lives in a year than most people in a lifetime. And what I often think about every morning when I get up, you know, somebody's going to go to work and they're going to build cars. Somebody's going to go to work and they're going to build computers. Somebody's going to go to work and they're going to put together some tables. But for whatever reason, out of all the, you know, billions of people on this earth, the good man above had tapped me on the shoulder to say, I want you to mold the lives of these young men that I'm going to put in front of you. And he's given me the tool of the game of basketball to do that. And I just think that that's, I get up, to be honest with you, I'm so thankful every day. Like, man, what an awesome responsibility. And, you know, just how special I have to be you know, for all of us. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it's not a lot of people that do what we do. And so to be tapped on the shoulder, to be given that responsibility, I just think that's super, super special. And I just take that with me every morning, that I get to make a difference in the lives of these young men through a game that I love. I just thank the man above every day for being tapped on the shoulder and given that responsibility.
Awesome. That's a fantastic answer. And I want to wrap things up by talking about two other things that are part of your resume that I would be remiss if we didn't talk about, at least briefly. Talk a little bit about let's start out first with your consulting business, your speaking business. Just talk a little bit about what you do at that and how you try to bring value to people through that particular avenue as opposed to just strictly your coaching.
So one of the things that we do is we go out and we share with nonprofits, business, coaching clinics or whatever. I just think that sports, athletics, in particular basketball, has taught me so many positive life lessons that cross over into, as you've already said, business and sales and all of those kinds of things. And so one of the things I tell people simply, my consulting business is about is teaching you how to think like a winner and act like a champion.
I like it. I think that it's something that I've had the opportunity through a friend of mine to get an opportunity to hear a variety of speakers talk on the theme of excellence. And every time I walk away from getting an opportunity to hear somebody speak, I've always had my notebook in front of me and I'm always taking notes and trying to learn and trying to grow. And that's kind of been a theme of, you know, what you and I talked about over the course of this hour and whatever 20 minutes that we've been talking, is just the need for you to continue to grow and improve. And I think that by getting out there and sharing the things that you've been able to have success with as a high school basketball coach, it's tremendous that you're able to then pass that on and pass that knowledge on so that, again, as you said, what you're doing is going to continue to live on outside of you when you share your knowledge. And the last thing I want to talk about, which as I look through and learn more about you, it was the most interesting piece of information on your resume, is when you are the general manager and head coach of a professional team. So talk to me a little bit about how that came to pass and what that experience was like. I think it's a fun way to kind of wrap things up here.
So I got an opportunity to coach in the ABA, which has now become a minor league professional basketball league. And so I'd had a lot of success in high school. A friend of mine reached out, actually made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, offered me the opportunity to run a ABA team. And so we pulled together a lot of guys that I had coached again in high school who had finished college, some who had been playing overseas. Team was called the Minnesota Ripneys, played a season in the ABA, went up right to the championship game. It was in 2008, right as the last, what do you call it? The economy, you know.
The last recession.
Last recession, yes. So the recession hit, and the owner had put in a significant amount of money, and so he just decided that we couldn't move forward. But you know what? But I'll tell you what I got from it, though. I learned as much as I liked it, and it was fun being a general manager and making trades and coaching and doing all those kind of things. But I learned that I'm a high school basketball coach. And that my true purpose that I had been put on earth to really take those 13 and 14-year-old boys that come to me in the 8th and 9th grade and turn them into young men that leave me at 18 years old. So that as much as I love that, what I really love and what I'm really good at is taking boys and helping them become men through the game of basketball.
That's fantastic that you were able to have that experience and then not only enjoy the experience itself, but then it also helped to clarify for you where you should be and what you should be all about. And I can tell from talking to you tonight the passion that you have for the kids in your program and for just making a difference in their lives comes through loud and clear. And to me, that's really, as I said from the beginning, I've matured as a coach over the course of time, and I've thought about the game of basketball differently from the start of my career when I was first in the coaching profession up until now, where early in my career, it wasn't necessarily about using the game as a vehicle to improve kids' lives. And I think as your story illustrates, you've sort of had that as your focus from the very beginning, and it comes through loud and clear. And we can't thank you enough for spending this time with us tonight, Larry. It's been an absolute pleasure for me getting a chance to know you and have this conversation. And we thank you for spending the time and taking the time out of your schedule to join us here on the Hoop Ends Pod. And to everyone else out there, we appreciate you listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us, so we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their ultimate shooting guide and video program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.